Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Coming up on DTNS, CES is off. Are we sad? A bet for clean nuclear power hits a milestone in France, and Andrew Main explains how he let us have AI conversations with Ada Lovelace and the Hulk. This is the Daily Tech News for Tuesday, July 28th, 2020 in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Merritt.
And from Studio Redwood, I'm Sarah Lane.
And I'm the show's producer, Roger Chang.
Author of The Girl Beneath the Sea, Andrew Main is with us. How's it going, Andrew?
Fantastic.
You've been working with OpenAI and allowing us to talk with any author that's not alive. That's pretty cool.
Any person,
right? Not just an author.
Anybody, fictional or otherwise. Yeah,
exactly. So we will talk a little bit more about that later in the show. We were just talking about how Andrew came about that. We may, on Good Day Internet, have David Foster Wallace's favorite movies. So if you want that wider conversation, become a member, patreon.com/DTNS. Let's start with a few tech things you should know.
Spotify updated its group sessions beta feature to let up to 5 premium subscribers listen to music or podcasts together. All members of the listening party's host and guest can control playback. They can skip tracks or episodes and then add items to the queue. You know, alone together. Spotify first launched group sessions in beta back in May.
Google announced plans to build an undersea cable to connect the UK, Spain, and the United States. It's Google's 4th privately owned undersea cable. Now, that will help Google save some money, but an industry insider told DTNS the average user will see nothing from this, although it is nice to see new fiber in the water. An example of a cable that might actually impact your general use is the Oman to Perth cable to be completed in December 2021. That will be the only cable directly connecting Europe, Middle East, and Africa to Australia and avoiding routes through the South China Sea.
Intel announced Monday that its chief engineering officer, Dr. Venkata Murthy Renduchintala, will leave the company on August 3rd. His technology systems architecture and client group will be split into 5 teams: technology development, manufacturing, design engineering, architecture, and supply chain management, all reporting to Intel CEO Bob Swan.
Netflix received the most Emmy nominations of any studio, digital or otherwise, with 160. Ozark alone had 18, though HBO's Watchmen had more than that. Amazon got 31 nominations total, Hulu 26, Apple TV Plus 20, Disney Plus 19, mostly for The Mandalorian. Quibi got 10, Oculus got 3, and YouTube got 2.
Look at Quibi. Folding at Home and Rosetta at Home both now support ARM64 devices, meaning you can run them on Android devices, Raspberry Pi devices, and more. Both projects are being used for research on the coronavirus. Good Day Internet has a Folding at Home team that you can join if you haven't already.
And it's time to check in on SARS-CoV-2 vaccine progress. As we mentioned, phase 3 vaccine trials are the ones used to demonstrate effectiveness in a large group of people and usually the last step before a vaccine can be submitted for approval for use. Vaccines from AstraZeneca, Sinovac, China National Biotech are all already in phase 3. And Monday, a vaccine from Moderna began its 30,000-person phase 3 trial at more than 100 sites in the United States. A vaccine from CanSino is also approved for use by the Chinese military and in negotiations with several countries to begin its phase 3 trial. All right, let's talk about CES.
Let's do it. The Consumer Technology Association, who are the folks who put on CES each year, announced that there will be no physical event in January 2021 after initially planning a hybrid in-person and virtual show. Instead, an all-virtual format will let exhibitors and attendees and also the press engage through online talks and meetings. The CTA says it consulted with more than 10,000 attendees and other stakeholders in the show and found out many just didn't want to physically attend due to health concerns about the virus. The CEO, Shapiro, unfortunately, I forget his first name. Gary Shapiro said, quote, "We realized with no vaccine, it's just not possible to have a physical CES. Our event has been primarily an indoor event. If it were a financial decision, we would go forward." He cited a shortage of physical tests as one element of the decision as well. The 2022 CES is still planned as a hybrid physical and digital event based on what the CTA learns from this coming one.
So we're all very sad that we will not be able to eat the shriveled apples in the press luncheon kits. And
get kind of jostled, you know, going through the LG big booth. And I mean, that's the thing is when we, because DTNS has been going for some years now, and you know, we've all been there in years past, we're all very well aware of how crowded it can get, particularly when the show opens to public. So the whole idea of it being hybrid, when we heard about this a couple months ago, which was what a lot of shows were sort of mulling over, it was like, okay, well, that's smart. But how would that even work? I mean, it would be just completely different experience. You'd have to, you know, you'd have to trickle people in really slowly and, you know, force people out at a certain time so other people could come through. It sounded like a mess to me.
Yeah. And it was at a time when we thought the infections were starting to trail off. So January felt like, well, maybe by then it won't be so bad. And then, of course, we saw some resurgences. And I think that's why the CTA decided to make the decision it did. DTNS didn't go to CES for the first few years. And what we missed was getting in touch with people, having people that were there easily just come by and be on the show that might not be able to otherwise. And if you're not going to have a lot of people there, I was still wondering, like, even if I feel safe, if am I going to get that benefit out of going? So they've taken the decision out of my hands for this year. Andrew, as someone who consumes the news coming out of CES, is this something that changes your mind at all about it?
I think that sort of like some of the more interesting cycles sort of started to happen outside CES, besides like, you know, how, you know, the resolution of TVs, you know? So I kind of think that maybe it's for the better.
Yeah.
To sort of.
I think it's probably fine. We're going to get all the same amount of news. And like I said, having covered CES locally without being in Las Vegas the first few years, I never felt like I was missing out on the news. I was missing out on just meeting the people. And that's just something we're used to right now.
Well, and there's an energy thing that you just up in person, which is, you know, I think that's when people talk about, okay, well, we can, you know, many of us can work remotely. Well, we're all working remotely now, but folks who did not have to and now are forced to have, you know, come to the conclusion at sometimes, oh, this is actually better for me, or this is easier than I thought it would be. So as somebody who's been to the show many years in a row, I wonder how we'll feel disconnected if we do at all.
There are a lot of these smaller shows. Like, I have a friend who's an electrical engineer, and he talks about going to, like, oh, I went to this optics show or this other thing here, and there's stuff, some consumer ready and some amazing stuff there that you might never see at a CES. And so it might be kind of interesting to see if the shift is covering smaller sort of industry sort of shows where it's not all about the LG booth, you know, you know.
Well, let's talk about nuclear fusion. Fusion is different than fission. Fission is the one that splits atoms and releases radioactivity. Fusion combines atoms, releasing a lot of energy with less radioactivity, quite a small amount of radioactivity. If you can get fusion to work, the idea is you have an abundant source of energy with no carbon emissions, using very small amounts of fuel, no physical possibility of a meltdown. And that just sounds better to a lot of people. The world's biggest nuclear fusion project ITER, I-T-E-R, has entered its five-year assembly phase in Saint-Paul-les-Durance, southern France. ITER is a collaboration between 35 partner countries, including Switzerland, the UK, and the European Union, which provide 45% of the funding, as well as funding and other contributions from China, India, Japan, South Korea, Russia, and the United States. ITER will confine hot plasma in a structure called a tokamak to control fusion reactions. If all goes on schedule, it would go online December 2025 and produce 200 megawatts of power. That's enough for about 200,000 homes or so. So essentially, this is a very expensive proof of concept. And the hope is that more affordable commercial designs could be made based on ITER. But Andrew, as we were talking before the show, there are already a lot of commercial efforts happening as well right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of other theories on how you could achieve sustainable fusion. So there's a number of startups with different approaches. You know, the ITER, you know, idea, it's sort of like the DOE's been doing for years here. It's one approach, and we haven't been putting a lot of money at different sort of ways to do it. And there's a lot of capital, like Bill Gates is funding, like at least one or two different ones. And you've got, I think, some of the Google founders are doing that too. So there's a lot of other efforts out there. And that's what's exciting now. It's the first time we're trying different approaches towards doing it. Because the tokamak design, you know, one of the original people who worked on that, Robert Bussard, later on went to say, like, no, I think this is a dead end.
Yeah. And it is an old design. Not to say they shouldn't try it, but I wouldn't put all my hopes on this being not only that this be the one that works, but this being the only one that could work, because there's a lot of efforts out there. But it's interesting to keep an eye on and know that, okay, they're finally building it. They've been talking about this for a long time. They've been doing the pre-work on it for a long time. And so they're finally having parts show up and start to be assembled. So it'll be interesting to keep an eye on it.
A study by the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, has found that wearing face masks that adequately cover the mouth and nose causes the error rate of many facial recognition algorithms to rise between 5 and 50%. Black masks were more likely to cause errors than blue masks, and the more of the nose covered by the mask, the more the algorithm struggled to correctly identify a face. However, NIST's report only tested a type of facial recognition known as one-to-one matching, where an algorithm checks to see if a target's face matches the face on an ID, like a passport, often used at border control or airline boarding. The study didn't examine the kind of facial recognition used to unlock phones. They use depth sensors. And NIST also didn't evaluate one-to-many algorithms. Those are what's used in mass surveillance, where a crowd is scanned to find matches with faces in a database already. NIST plans to evaluate one-to-many systems later this year, as well as algorithms designed to recognize mask wearers.
I mean, if you look at this practically, I'm sure you could say, like, oh, well, at a border or boarding an airline, I suppose you could ask someone to take their mask off briefly to be identified, since it's one-to-one. One-to-many is a whole different problem. And unlocking your phone, that's meant to make sure it doesn't unlock unless it absolutely has the right face. So that's a different problem, too. There seem to be some improvements in that, where people can train it with their mask and it starts to work. But the whole problem is you're missing half the data, right, Andrew? Like, from the nose down, if you got a mask on, you can't measure those points and compare them. You have to work around the eyes.
I'm writing this down. Masks make facial recognition difficult. and these algorithms for facial recognition, I don't know if we've had any yet that were trained from nose up. And that's one of the things that you'll find out, that all of a sudden, if you start saying, well, let's do a bunch of data sets where we train from the nose up to the eyes, we might be surprised all of a sudden the efficiency will go up. So if you say, yeah, we used an algorithm trained on the whole face, doesn't work when you can't see the whole face, that's shocking to nobody if you know what's going involved there. There are some really cool next generation algorithms that are actually able to sort of recreate depth data, even from, you know, regular 2D cameras and stuff. And I think that's going to be exciting to see what happens when you start creating depth data and doing that. I think they're going to get way more capable. So I think it's a solvable thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is the motivation to solve it, right? Already seeing the earliest companies claiming to have solved it, whether they have or not, which means, you know, we'll soon have workable ways to solve this. And if you didn't quite get it, the reason you need depth sensing unlocking your phone is you don't want it to get fooled by a picture. Whereas at the border, when you're doing one-to-one, you're using a picture. You're like, there's a person, I'm using a picture to match it. So you don't care about that aspect. That's why you don't use depth sensing in the one-to-one. But all of this is going to get better. And I think you're right. This is just a study that says, yep, what we knew was difficult sure is difficult. And now let's start talking about how to fix it. And I wouldn't, if you're someone who's thinking like, aha, facial recognition is finally defeated, I don't think this is a situation where that's the case.
No, it needs to be reimagined at the very least.
We'll just go to barcodes on foreheads. Problem solved.
Yeah, I think some people might have more of a problem with that than wearing a mask. I don't know.
Face tats are in, Tom.
That's true. You got to make it cool, and then everybody will just do it. CNET's Stephen Shanklin has a great write-up on progressive web apps causing a conflict between Apple and Google. Progressive web apps, or PWA, are basically websites that can be saved to your desktop or your home screen and work without a network and do app-like things like synchronize data and deliver push notifications. But web apps work in any browser, no matter what operating system you use, or at least they're meant to. Google's Fugu project is adding PWA capabilities to Chromium, which would then show up in Microsoft Edge, Opera, Brave, Google Chrome, and others. But Apple's Safari is not Chromium-based, and on iOS, you can only use browsers based on Safari's WebKit engine. So adding something to Chromium doesn't make it work on iOS or Safari. So PWA features only show up in Safari or any iOS browser, even Chrome on iOS, if Apple adds the function to WebKit. And Apple recently published 16 web programming abilities it will not add to Safari because of privacy and security concerns. Among the features Apple doesn't support are notifications and prompts to install a PWA. You can go in and tell the Safari browser to install a PWA to your home screen as like it's an app, but you have to do it. They don't allow the website to prompt you to do that. Also, data sync and access to the file system are more restricted on Safari because of security concerns. So we're getting a little headbutting here, where the original iPhone didn't have an app store because Steve Jobs said web apps will be all you need. This is the fulfillment of that. But Apple now pushing themselves as the more private and secure option and also operating a fairly lucrative app store is a little more resistant to allowing PWAs to be as robust as they are on the Chromium engine. Andrew, does this surprise you?
Well, I mean, yes, Steve Jobs said that, but also he was looking to the point of having launched the iPhone, and the nightmare of trying to have an app store at launch was so terrifying for him. He's like, web apps are great. Love web apps. PWAs have become very powerful, but, you know, Apple obviously wants to protect their ecosystem, but the other side of it is it's like there is that, well, yeah, we should let you automatic notifications, all these other stuff. Apple worried. I think there's genuine security concerns there, like, you know, legit sort of issues with that, because you can do a lot of really powerful stuff in there, but you can also do a lot of powerful stuff in there.
Yeah, so. I don't think Google's being irresponsible by doing PWA, but on the other hand, they don't have as much of a laser-like focus. I look to Microsoft as sort of the arbiter on this sort of thing, but now they've sunk their future into Chromium on Microsoft Edge. I think there certainly is a way to do PWA secure, and just like there is a way to do a native app secure. So I hopefully this will be a productive tension, is I guess where I'm trying to go with that.
Yeah, I would say I love Google, but often they will err on the wrong side when it comes to security. You know, we saw that with, you know, the Google, you know, home device that was sending your voice unsecured, whatever, because they don't sell security as a service. Apple does. And so that's why I like, yeah, sure, they'll do it. And I'm like, whoopsie, sorry. You know, what are you going to do? Not buy Chrome? Oh, wait, you don't pay for it anyway. Sorry.
Yeah. And Firefox is another one to keep an eye on. Firefox is also a little more restrictive in the kind of progressive web apps it allows in the desktop version of Firefox. And again, same thing. They are pushing privacy and security as their product. So another one to look at to see, okay, where might that line really be without any other kind of biases?
Hey, folks. Do you use any PWA? I'm sorry. Do you use any? I've never installed one.
I have a PWA for the Financial Times. And for a game called Gold Digger that was released with the original iPhone as a PWA. And I've had it on ever since. Those are the only two.
Okay.
Hey, folks, if you want to get all the tech headlines each day in about 5 minutes, be sure to subscribe to DailyTechHeadlines.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high volume, high speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
On June 11th, OpenAI released its first API in public beta, leveraging OpenAI's GPT-3 model, letting you train the model on any text and use that model and the API's general English training set for any natural language task. Janelle Shane of AI Weirdness used it to simulate We Rate Dogs. There's a startup acquisition announcement generator that will, quote, generate a tone-deaf announcement post crafted by a neural network trained on hundreds of breathless press releases. But my favorite, and I'm biased because he's my friend, is Andrew Main's AI writer at AIwriter.app. Andrew, what is AI writer?
So I started working with the API several months ago, doing a lot of different stuff with it. And I built out an app called AIChannels.app, which was a conversational sort of app where you could talk to different fictional characters and stuff. And I knew releasing that was a bit further out, so I just wanted to come up with an easy way for people to interact, you know, with virtual characters, et cetera, via OpenAI's API. So I created AIWriter.app, and I went to OpenAI. I'm like, hey, I built this thing. Let me go through the process of releasing to the general public to let people use it and get feedback about it to find out what works, what doesn't work, et cetera. And so what you do is you just basically, once you get access, you just send an email to anybody you want. You write, dear Tom Merritt, you know, tell me the secrets of podcasting, which I may do that right now. And it will write you back and say, hey, from that person, if there's enough information about that person on the internet, it will respond to you. And so you can get very lengthy responses. I've had Benjamin Franklin write very lengthy, you know, responses to questions about, you know, being industrious, et cetera.
It feels so, very Benjamin Franklin. He was a lengthy writer.
Very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it'll write back in the style. Yeah.
And what I didn't realize until right before the show is that it does that for anybody. Like you don't have to have pre-trained your model on that person. You don't have a set of people that it's in the set of people who are out there on the internet. And if there's enough out there, they'll write back, which I think is more fantastic than people could have realized.
Yeah. And that's because the OpenAI, their API, it's trained on so much data, so much historical data, so much, you know, stuff out there that for somebody like me to come in and make an app on top of it, it's very easy. I just have to be able to ask it the right question and say, this is the kind of response I want.
How good is it?
Oh, sorry, yeah, Sarah. Yeah. That's kind of the same question I was going to ask. What have you noticed are the, you know, the biggest drawbacks or where it seems to flounder or even fail?
Well, you know, the like any text generator sort of model is that, you know, it will give you an answer no matter what. So, for instance, if you ask a question of something like, its data set ends in October of 2019. So if you ask it, let's say, what's COVID-19, it'll give you an answer, but it won't be an accurate one. It'll say it's like a Swedish punk band or whatever.
Right.
You know? So you have to be mindful if you write applications that are fact-based to say, okay, I need to build a fact filter that understands what to do that. So, you know, I built an app that would basically, I figured out how to find out how competent it is on the response. And if it had a low competence, I could then go ask Wikipedia and then say, summarize this back to me and then do that. And so that's what you're getting people to understand, that think of it like a really, really smart person who knows a lot of stuff that you can slip notes to under a door, and you ask them to do things back and forth. It's not going to do straight computational stuff. I mean, it can do some basic math and stuff, but if you ask it, you know, what's 1,000 times 5,000 divided by whatever, it may or may not give you an answer. But if you ask me, hey, what's a good equation for solving this problem, or, you know, which weighs more, a loaf of bread or an airplane? It'll know, tell you, an airplane. And so you have to sort of think a different mind way and have a different mindset.
Is it something that you see having a use, you know, because I think a lot of people look at this and go, that's fun. I can talk to the Hulk. Cool. But what can I use this for?
So I, for an example, like with our friend Justin Young, who works on doing political commentary, et cetera, and history, you know, I did some examples writing to Richard Nixon, asking him his points of view on stuff. Or you could write to people and say, you know, hey, what do you recommend? And you can get book recommendations, you know, from referencing people's stuff. You can ask Richard Feynman to explain to you how a quantum computer works and break it down on a simpler level. And that's kind of the really exciting part, is that you could write to people and say, what do you think about this? It's not really what they think, but it takes all the information out there to say, let's synthesize what would have been that response from that person. And so, you know, I had examples of, like, you know, people, the Jane Austen book club fan, you know, or who are like, you know, like the fact responses. There's other people who've done similar stuff with this, finding out that it gives you really good answers and it will give you historical context. You ask Ben Franklin a question about something contemporary to his times, he will make references to stuff that you may not even have been aware of. And you go, wow, that's legit. By the way, Virtual Tom Merritt gave me advice on the secret to podcasting.
And what did he say?
Dear Andrew, if you want to get better at podcasting, here's what I do. Talk to someone on your podcast you're nervous about. Pick an editor or producer you know. Then for every person on your podcast, listen to how that person speaks to their guests. And then repeat the process a couple more times until you're okay talking to people.
I mean, not bad advice.
Right. It's. I don't know if that's exactly what you would say, Tom. But if I heard that advice, I'd be like, that's pretty smart.
The first few sentences, I was like, yeah, that's kind of what I did. So, all right, yeah. I was thinking when you were describing this, that this is an excellent, and this, I'm certain this isn't the only use, but this is an excellent way to create more personal chatbots. All right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if I'm Bank of America, you know, I could have Benjamin Franklin be my customer assistance chatbot, right? Like you could pick personalities that you can then make people feel a little more confident talking to, because you're not just talking to faceless Joan or Pat or whatever. You're talking to somebody. They're like, oh, I know that person. You know, if it's a legal advice, you could have John Jay or some other historical person, and it lends it a little more approachability and makes people maybe loosen up a little.
You can do things too, like when people get API access, there's some tutorials and stuff, and there's some videos. Some of the videos are ones that I've made to help explain it. And one of the things I show is how to make a sarcastic chatbot, or how to make, you know, one that has a sense of humor and stuff, and how to give it more personality by providing examples. So it doesn't have to be a famous person. You might, let's say you're a company, you had an amazing customer service rep that was really good at de-escalating and keeping people calm. You can give them those examples of how to handle this. And then all of a sudden, your chatbot is way better at dealing with people than feeling like a machine.
Yeah. No, I think that's really interesting. One last thing before we get off this topic. On the AI Alignment Forum, machine learning researcher Andy Jones suggested we may be in what they call an overhang for AI. An overhang being when you have the ability for a transformative use of a technology, but nobody's quite realized it yet. The overhang ends when that transformative use arises and surprises everyone with its capability. He thinks GPT-3 could be the trigger for those kinds of transformative uses. What do you think?
I think that if you've been following AI research for the last couple of years, the rate at which you're getting new papers and new capabilities far exceeds the number of people trying to make use of them. And we're seeing examples now, like speech synthesis has had, in the last 18 months, light years in improvement, the ability to replicate individual voices and stuff and what's going on there. GPT-3 is an example of, I've mentioned this before, I went through and looked at all the things, and GPT-2 came out and they said, well, here's the problem, it can't do this and this. It was able to do all of those now. And so there's a lot of great stuff before you get to what they talk about AGI, which is artificial general intelligence, which is like just talking to a person and be able to convince you that they are a person, which this could fool Turing tests, by the way. This is totally,
I mean,
in my
your
opinion,
version of Turing says that, I noticed.
Yeah. Well, I took all the examples from historical Turing tests that it failed, but like that version of it. So that's not even that's, but that doesn't get into the utility of it. So I think there's a lot of stuff out there right now that, yes, absolutely. We're at this point where, as more and more people, you're looking at every day, if you follow the OpenAI or you follow some of the other people like Greg Brockman, you know, who are work, you know, who's the CTO, if you follow the stuff he's retweeting of other people doing stuff, you're seeing every day, it's like Christmas, if somebody come up with something new. You know, there's people creating plugins for Figma to generate entire user interfaces. They're creating React code, doing all kinds of stuff. So I think so.
Taking a lot of shots. That's how you hit.
Hey, thanks everybody who participates in our DTNS subreddit. You can submit stories. You could also vote on other stories so they rise to the top at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com.
Let's check out the mailbag.
Oh, let's. We had a great conversation with Andy Anotko, who was our guest yesterday, about, you know, the wide world of sports in the time of Corona. And Greg and Brian actually also both wrote in and said, fake crowds have been getting a lot of attention lately, but faked sounds in live sports, not new. Pre-recorded and video game sounds have been part of live sports broadcast for a decade. Your chat with Andy about the virtual fans reminded Greg that BBC Radio 4 did a show in 2011 called The Sound of Sports. Great backgrounder on how live sports and video games are merging and influencing one another. So it's been around for a while. Greg says, I also first heard the story courtesy of the podcast 99% Invisible. Brian mentioned the same. One of my favorite podcasts. So I thank you for reminding me that there's an old podcast that I should listen to of 99PI. Greg also says, as an aside, since you mentioned them in yesterday's show, I was involved in early experiments to add virtual down markers in NFL broadcasts. It was a partnership between the NFL, the technology developer, and the Canadian broadcaster that I was with at the time. We tried all sorts of things to test the tech, and things that worked well in testing would invariably go wrong when we were live on air. But if you're going to mess up a live NFL broadcast, better to mess up in Canada, where only 5% of the audience will be upset, rather than the U.S., where the NFL takes on a religious importance.
Go BC Lions. That's all I have to say. Thanks for sharing that story, Greg.
Unlike hockey for them.
Yes, you would not test it with hockey. Glowing right. Pucks. My goodness.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Shout out to patrons at our master and grandmaster levels, including Dan Dorado Hankins, John Johnston, and Chris Smith. Also, special thanks to Andrew Main for being with us today. Great information, Andrew. You're obviously doing some really creative work. Let folks know where they can keep up with it.
I'm on Twitter at Andrew Main or andrewmain.com. That's M-A-Y-N-E.
And folks, you can support us at any level and get perks. The best way to keep the show rolling, to keep us coming, is to support us directly on Patreon. You get a wider version of the show or not. You can choose to have just DTNS if you want. And you can get special columns from Roger, Live With It from Sarah, where she spends 3 months with technology, really putting it through its paces. That's all available at patreon.com/DTNS.
If you've got feedback for us, we've got an email address to send it to, feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. And if you can join us live, please do, Monday through Friday, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live.
Back tomorrow with Scott Johnson. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
You have enjoyed this program.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.